So, Rafer, one of the great things our listeners do, they write into us sometimes.
Yeah.
They call in, they write in. They call 5717 movies.
Yeah, call it. Call it, people. We love it when you call.
And, they go to our, what? Did you really just call it? Call it right now. Just
Sorry.
call it.
Was
Just
that
call
too breathy? Was that too sex phone operator for you? Sorry.
Oh, God. Okay. I've totally forgot what I was talking about. Oh, that's right. People call in a lot and they ask if we can do documentaries. And yes, of course we can do documentaries. And what we're going to do today is actually a summer documentary roundup in honor of those people who've called in, who've written into our Facebook page to ask what our favorite documentaries are. So we're just going to focus on summer 2012 documentaries. But before we do that, let's introduce ourselves. Should I do it breathy?
Yeah.
This is Kristen Meinzer.
And I'm Rafer Guzman, movie critic for Newsday, and this is Movie Date. I was trying to channel Barry White. I don't know if that worked or not.
Oh God. Well, I Barry White. I love that Barry White. He's all right.
Who doesn't?
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about some of the great documentaries that are out this summer. Rafer, why don't you start with one?
Okay. We've struck the wrong tone. Documentaries are supposed to be so serious, and here we are being flippant. By the way, we're going to skip trivia this week because we've got so many movies to get into, because Kristen has picked two documentaries to review briefly. I've picked two, and then we are also going to discuss a fifth documentary. We each picked three, and we wound up picking the same one.
Yes, yes.
Which is good, because that's really possibly the best of them all, or at least the most interesting of them all. So I'm going to start off with a movie called The Imposter. Directed by a guy named Bart Layton.
And the judge said, listen, the only way for you to prove that it's you're really Nicholas, we got pictures here that you've never seen before. I'm going to show you five of them. Number one, okay. Number two, okay. Number three, okay. And number four, okay. On the five one, I made a mistake.
I'm going to give it, I'll give you the brief summary. True story, obviously. 1994, San Antonio, Texas. A 13-year-old boy, Nicholas Barclay, goes missing. No trace, just vanishes from his,
oh, I've
vanishes
heard of
from
this
his
movie.
Home.
Okay. I've heard of this.
All right, 3 years later, something that never happens in missing persons cases like this, especially with children, happens. He's discovered in Linares, Spain. The authorities check him out. The local authorities in Spain check him out. The embassies check this out. The authorities here check this out. The FBI checks this out. It's him. It's Nicholas Barclay, now 16 years old.
Hold on. Do they have DNA testing and everything?
They do not. That's a very good question, and I don't know how. I don't know where that technology was back then. It wasn't that long ago, but you know, DNA technology has advanced pretty fast. I don't know if they do that kind of thing. But they check it out as thoroughly as they can. Everyone agrees this is certainly Nicholas Barclay, little 13-year-old blonde boy who disappears from Texas. They give him back to his family. Only now, strangely enough, he has a really dark 5 o'clock shadow. His blonde hair is black. His blue eyes are black. And he's speaking with a really strong French accent. And the family takes him in and says, huh, okay, welcome back, Nicholas. And
oh,
the guy
that's so sad.
Becomes part of the family. Clearly, it's not Nicholas. It's a guy named Frederick Bourdin. He's a French Algerian, I think, serial imposter who's 23 years old. He's amassed about 500 different identities, three of which have been actual missing children.
Oh, my God.
A complete, I don't know what the clinical term is, but a complete psychopath. This film includes interviews, extensive interviews with the family. And with him, much of the film is one-on-one interviews with
him. From
his
prison cell?
No.
What? He's not in prison after all this?
No. In fact, he just tweeted me the other day.
No.
Yeah, after my review of the film ran.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah.
What did he tweet
yeah,
you?
Yeah, it's awesome. He liked my review.
Wow.
I don't know. Is that good or bad?
Careful.
Here's
he might
I,
be you.
Here's what I want to say. Here's what I want to say. What I have told you is about half the story. And I'm going to leave it there. And I'm just going to say that this is one of the best documentaries I have seen in years. It's absolutely a jaw dropper. The story is astounding and it's told so well. It's so mind boggling and it unfolds like such a wonderful, wonderful mystery. You just can't believe it's true. There's a crusty old private eye who comes in. There's, I mean, you know, the FBI, you know, investigator who starts, you know, scratching her head saying, something seems wrong here. There are all these characters in it, the family, the impersonator. It's extraordinary. I would highly recommend it to everybody. I don't know if it's going to be in theaters still because it came out a little while ago, but it is, I think, rentable. It's on VOD. I really, really suggest it to anyone. It's incredible.
Wow. It doesn't even sound like this could possibly happen in real life.
It's been written about before. There has been a New Yorker article on this guy, Bourdain, this documentary is just such an incredible telling of the story. I could not believe it while I was watching it. It's great.
Wow.
That's my first recommendation.
Shocking and crazy.
Shocking and crazy.
Well, the next movie we're going to talk about is one of my picks, which some people might also think is shocking and crazy. It's called Meet the Fockins.
Oh, yes. I'm really curious about this.
The original title in Europe is Old Whores. It's about identical twin prostitutes who are 69 at the time the movie's made in Amsterdam's red light district. And they've been working as prostitutes for over 50 years, I believe.
Wow.
Yeah, and one of them had to retire 2 years ago because her arthritis really kicked in, and she can, in her own words, not even get one leg over the other now, but I used to be so agile.
Wow.
And
I can't even think of a joke to make about that.
And you see the women at work, at play. You see them shopping for condoms and sex toys. You see them interacting with their neighbors. You learn a little bit about their backgrounds and how they got into the work. And I have to say, these two old broads are kind of great women.
Really?
Regardless of what they do for a living, they're just so honest about it. They're willing to laugh about it.
Interesting.
Their personal histories are not the happiest.
I'm sure.
There are some sad parts about their personal history, which I do wish they went into more.
Uh-huh.
They don't really delve into that much. But you really see a lot of things about the life of an Amsterdam prostitute. And
wow.
Yes. I mean, I'm talking a lot of things. The camera is right there. We're talking.
Oh, sign me up.
We're talking up close and personal.
Oh, I'm there.
Close-ups of stuff.
How have I missed this movie?
I know.
Do they talk at all? Do they get into any of the issues surrounding legal versus illegal prostitution? The rights of sex workers, that kind of thing?
They do talk about how the sisters started their own business to get out from under the thumb of organized crime.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And they also talk about how all these new girls are being shipped in from other countries.
Oh, wow.
But mostly we just see them working, laughing, making the best of their situation. And if you want some tips about what you can do when you're with your special man, they do have some tips.
Oh.
So all you folks out there who have a special man or enjoy the company of special men, maybe you should see it just for that reason. You might learn a thing or two from these ladies.
Wow.
Yeah.
I really got to see that movie. I recently read Chester Brown. He's a cartoonist, and he wrote a graphic novel called Paying for It. It's an autobiographical graphic novel all about his life as a John.
Oh, wow.
In Canada. And it's also an extensive note section in the back that is all about his arguments for why prostitution is not immoral and should be legal. So that really makes me want to see that movie. I really want to see that.
Check it out. I want to know what you think about it. I really want to know what you think about it.
Okay, so my next pick is a documentary that didn't get a lot of traction when it came out. It's called Shelley Wright, Wish Me Away.
I said, there's one more song, Rodney, that out of all these songs, I haven't played for you. But it's the musical heart of what these songs that we're recording is about.
Do you know the name Shelley Wright, Kristen?
The name sounds familiar, but I don't know.
Okay, I did not know who she was going into this, but because I'm not a big country music fan, but in the late 90s, sort of 97, 98 in there, she was a real hot rising country music star. She did have a song that I recognized, which was a big hit, Single White Female. So she, and she, you know, beautiful, beautiful, typical Nashville looking country music star, you know, flowing hair and, you know, made of high cheekbones and, you know, gorgeous the way they're all gorgeous. And has a long, you know, public romance with Brad Paisley. So she's really becoming,
yes, that's,
you know,
why I know this story.
That's why you
that's
know the name.
Know
there
the
you go.
Story.
There you go.
Oh,
so, you know,
yes,
she's really becoming, yes, you know, kind of country music royalty. And in 2010, she publicly comes out as gay. And it's this huge deal in the country music world. I feel like it didn't make the hugest shockwaves, maybe throughout the mainstream culture at large, but in the country music world, it was a big, big deal. She is definitely the first star, major star, to, you know, someone who's played the Grand Ole Opry, who's been, you know, welcomed, wholeheartedly embraced into the Nashville scene, comes out as gay. And it's a pretty, it was made, you know, clearly with her cooperation. It has a little bit of I don't want to say infomercial, but it doesn't feel like the most objective documentary. It feels a little bit more like almost like a diary from her. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of there's a lot of footage of her sort of speaking to her camera or to her cell phone, sort of recording her thoughts. As the days count down to where she's going to embark on this massive publicity campaign and tell the world that she's gay. But it's pretty interesting to hear just a really heartfelt first-person account of what it's like to live a massive public lie and to feel that everyone who is making her career possible and everyone who loves her and who is her friend and who is her colleague in this world, to feel that all those people would essentially abandon her if they knew the truth, that's pretty strong. And it's that alone kind of made the movie worth seeing to me. I don't think it's necessarily a great piece of documentary filmmaking, but it's pretty interesting, very topical, and I think it's worth seeing.
I need to see that.
Yeah, it's good.
Have I told you I'm a Brad Paisley fan?
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
Are
I am
you?
I am a Brad Paisley
Brad
fan.
Brad Paisley, yeah. Not in the movie.
Oh, I was curious about whether he would be or not. I know the country music world definitely, not that there's a side to take on this, but the country music world definitely took his side on this one.
Oh, I'm sure. And I one objection I think I have to the film is that they never quite seem to, they never get the other side. They never talk to anybody in the country music establishment to ask them their opinions about that. I don't know if that's because nobody would talk or if that's because they just didn't bother, but there was that voice missing for me in the film. That was one big objection I had to it.
All right, so the next movie, another music movie. So many of these are music movies.
Yes.
It feels like. The next movie, let's talk about Searching for Sugarman.
I'm very jealous that you've seen this and that I haven't.
We didn't know who this guy was. All our other rock stars, we had all the information we needed. But this guy, it was nothing. And then we found out that he had committed suicide. He set himself alight on stage and burned to death in front of the audience. It was the most incredible thing. It wasn't just a suicide. It was probably the most grotesque suicide in rock history.
You need to see this.
Really?
Everybody needs to see Searching for
Sugarman.
Oh,
really? You liked it that much?
I found myself so moved by this.
Wow.
I got incredibly emotional during this movie, and I think it's hard not to. It's a great mystery story. It's a great urban legend sort of story.
Uh-huh, yeah.
It's a great every man makes good sort of story. It's about this guy named Rodriguez. That's his name, just simply Rodriguez.
Yeah, Sixto Rodriguez,
Sixto
I think,
Rodriguez.
Is his real name, right?
That's
or Daniel real... Sixto, yeah, some kind of odd name.
Yeah, but when he was a recording artist back in the early 1970s, he put out 2.5 albums.
Yeah.
And he wrote on a level that people compared constantly to Bob Dylan, but it was much more sophisticated than that. And he had just a beautiful singing voice, better than James Taylor's voice.
Hmm.
And he was supposed to be the next big thing when he was discovered in Detroit. All this money was dumped into making these albums, having him do appearances, photo shoots, and so on. But then he was just a complete flop.
Yep.
Just a complete flop. But meanwhile, on the other side of the world, South Africa.
Yeah, of all places, right?
He's bigger than Elvis there.
Right.
He is just huge. He has no idea that he's been selling hundreds of thousands of records in South Africa. People are bootlegging them. People are copying these albums. People are buying them. People are bringing them in from the U.S. And He has no idea. He's living just a modest life in Detroit. He has three daughters. He does manual labor and really is living in poverty. Some people think he's homeless. Some of his friends and neighbors don't even realize that he has a house.
Wow.
And meanwhile, in South Africa, people say in the movie that there were only three albums that any good middle class person had back then. They were Bridge Over Troubled Water by Simon and Garfunkel,
yeah,
Abbey Road by the Beatles, and
Cold Fact.
Cold Fact.
No kidding.
Yes.
And, I'll be darned.
And it's amazing. He never got any royalties.
Oh,
the
wow.
producer appears on camera briefly, who just doesn't want to talk about what happened to the money.
Mm-hmm, I'll bet.
The filmmakers ask, well, just a second. You probably were getting millions of dollars in royalty checks
right.
from South Africa. And of course, he's like, I don't want to talk to you anymore.
Yeah.
So we find out that in South Africa, not only has he had all these people cheering for him and loving him and buying his albums, but there's a giant crazy legend about how he went out, that he was a huge star for a few years and then he set himself on fire on stage, or
oh,
he
wow.
shot himself on stage.
Nobody oh, wow.
knows how he died, and nobody knows why they never see him. There are no appearances by him ever, but the filmmakers just, they want to know more about, did he really die this way? Did he shoot himself? Because there are so many stories about how he died. And while they're searching for the real story of how Rodriguez died, they find out he's actually alive.
Right, right.
And the movie just goes crazy from there.
Interesting.
And I know you're not a big crier, Rafer, but you're going to cry when you see this.
Okay,
you're going to
okay.
bawl.
Oh, we'll see about that.
You're going to be crying like a little baby.
We'll see about that. Okay. All right. Well, then let's. I'm glad to hear that's good. So now let's talk about the documentary that's gotten a lot of buzz, probably the most talked about documentary over the summer, The Queen of Versailles.
Well, we're listing the house finished for $100 million, unfinished for $75 million. We've got over $50 million into it, plus the land and all that, and the bankers want us to unload it for under $15 million.
A timeshare magnate, David Siegel, who
and
owns...
And his wife, Jackie.
And his wife, his much younger wife, she's his junior by something like, what is it?
Over 30 years.
Yeah, over 30 years. He's 70-something, she's 40-something. It's not as though she's, you know, 20.
Oh, that's totally fine.
Well, that's fine. It's fine with me. So he's, you know, this very, very wealthy guy. He and Jackie are building the world's largest house. It's the
private home.
Yeah, the world's largest private home, right. You know, it's the go-go economy. The timeshare industry is booming. It's Florida. You know, land is cheap. They're going to build a 90,000-square-foot home in Orlando.
With 10 kitchens.
10 kitchens, something like, what is it, 17 bathrooms, you know, tennis courts, bowling alley, health spa, sushi bar,
they're
the
already
whole
in a 26,000-square-foot house, and they just are growing out. Oh,
they're growing out of it.
The
they're
seams.
Growing out of it. They do have a lot of kids, right? They've got like about 8 kids, so there is that.
Even with the 8 kids, though,
yeah,
just bursting at the seams. 26,000 feet is not enough.
My favorite part of the house is that it also has an observation deck so they can watch the nightly fireworks from Disneyland nearby.
Yes, they can. And there's a bowling alley.
Yes.
And a baseball field.
Yes.
Two tennis courts.
So they're building this house. Everything's going great. They've got, you know, they fly private jets everywhere. They're living the life that you and I only read about. And then the bottom drops out of the economy, and all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, but in pretty short order, Jackie is shopping at Walmart for Christmas, and she's buying a lottery ticket, and the business is on the ropes. The house goes into foreclosure.
They have to fire most of their servants.
They go down to four servants, whereas they used to have 19. So mm-hmm. that's a big cut.
The dogs and cats are just pooing all over the house.
The pet lizard dies. They start flying commercial. God forbid. I mean, things are bad.
They rent a car and have to drive the car themselves.
Drive the car. Where's my driver? Jackie asks the guy at the Hertz counter. One of the best scenes of the film. The expression on that guy's face is priceless. But it really is. It's not a riches to rags story, because that's how it was described in the Sundance film catalog, and David Siegel sued them over that. So I won't say that it's a riches to rags story, although he says it himself in the film.
Yes, he does.
But it is a pretty extraordinary story of a wealthy family being brought down many rungs on the economic ladder and grappling with a new reality. My question to you, Kristen, is How did you feel about these people? How did you feel about them and their situation and the way they dealt with it?
Okay, so this is the shocking part. I went in fully prepared to hate these people.
Oh, it's just got Schadenfreude written all over it, right?
Oh, yeah. I totally thought I was going to go in there and I was just going to hate them because I don't like their values. I don't like the idea that they're making all of their money off of not quite middle-class people. The timeshare
yes.
business is really predatory. It's really chasing after the same people who got subprime mortgages back
yes, exactly.
5 years ago. And I don't think these people are practicing what I would call good morals. And yet, I found Jackie and David so likable.
Yeah.
I was shocked. I thought, Jackie, you're an awesome person, actually.
Yeah.
You're fun. You're outgoing. You love your children. And you're smart. You're
yeah.
one of those people who grew up in lower middle class circumstances yourself.
Well, she got a degree in computer engineering, right? From
yeah.
from Binghamton or something like
yeah,
that.
But she decided,
mean, yeah.
yeah, in her town, you could either become an engineer or a secretary to an engineer because everybody
yeah.
worked for IBM. And she said, I'm not going to be anyone's secretary. So when she was a teenager, she went and she got an engineering degree.
Yeah.
And she is a smart woman. And I think really patient, really decent. And she seems incredibly kind-hearted.
And
maybe a little too kind-hearted because she gets a little bit, you know, she's not always treated in the best way by David.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things about the film is that she presents when you first look at them and they are, you know, one of these couples, I'll just go ahead and say it, that, you know, prove that money cannot buy taste. You know, I mean their house is just a horror show of, you know, Baroque furniture and animal skins and boudoir portraits of the two of them. And what's that great painting they have where like
he's like on a horse.
Yeah,
or
and she's like some kind of satyr or something. And he's got like, you know, the Caesar laurels around his head. Just ridiculous stuff. The vases, the just everything you're thinking is crammed into that house. And you see her, you know, it's never brought up in the film, but it's pretty clear that she's got enormous breast implants because you see
her aging over the years in various pictures.
You see earlier pictures of her and she's got no breasts at all. And then now at 40-something, she's got these huge breasts that are bigger than her head. And she's blonde and she's overly tanned. She presents this very typical picture of, you know, and she's a former beauty queen. She looks like a gold digger. She looks like the chick who's going to abandon the rich guy as soon as things get rough. And in fact, things turn out quite the opposite. She deals with the crisis far better than David Siegel does. He really kind of spirals into a bit of a depression, and she winds up holding the family together. And it's kind of interesting to see and surprising. One of the things that I think fascinated me about this movie is that it just seemed like such an exercise in relativism. I mean, that, you know, my wife and I are the Siegels to somebody else. I mean, you know, the apartment that we have, the money that we pay for childcare, we own our own place, we have a car, you know, we live pretty well, we go out and have a nice dinner. We are not rich by any means, but I'm sure that we look quite privileged and entitled and spoiled to somebody else, probably right here in another part of, you know, another part of New York City. And it really just made me feel like, you know, it just, my heart went out to them because I just felt like, I'm you, you know, and David Siegel even says at one point, you know, there's a lot of blame to go around for this. I'm like everybody else. I bought into the lie of cheap money. I overspent, I overleveraged myself and now I'm paying for it. And I just thought, yeah, aren't we all doing that? Aren't we all living beyond our means? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I actually felt a lot of that myself, too, when I saw it. And I know that you're better off than most people in the world, Rafe, or I'm better off than most people in the world. We're both much better off than most people in the world. But I do have to reiterate, the Siegels made all of their money off of predatory
yes, okay.
lending real estate practices.
Okay.
I have never made a dime off of trying to be a predator.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
And I don't know about you. Maybe you have.
I never have. No,
you
I
haven't?
Have. Not as far as I know.
Okay. All right. Well, I think it's a great movie.
And you really, you'd be hard-pressed to find a documentary that gets more candid interviews from its subjects. People are shockingly, ill-advisedly candid on camera, saying things that you just think, ooh, dude, don't say that. Don't say that. You're talking about your business here. Don't say that on camera.
Oh,
you know?
I think that's illegal. Oh, you're admitting it's illegal.
Oh, it's incredible.
Oh, stop it. Stop
it's
it.
Incredible.
Don't say anything else.
Yeah. Oh, it's amazing. And you know, personal admissions, it's really extraordinary. The director, Lauren Greenfield, she really deserves, you know, high praise for this movie. It's great. It's one of the best movies I've seen all year.
I think all the movies we talked about today, definitely good dates.
Yes, definitely good dates. I'm going to see those two that you recommended.
I'm going to have to see those two that you recommended also.
Right.
And then what we're going to do is go back to our Hollywood Fair, the stuff we talk about all the rest of the time.
Yep, then we'll go back to the wide releases,
the
fireballs and the explosions.
Oh, I love me some explosions. And singing.
And singing.
Did you know that you can follow Movie Date on Twitter and Facebook? You can also give us feedback on the podcast and tell us what movies you want us to see next.
Log on to themoviedate.org to find out more. And thanks so much for listening. I wonder I do.